but lashing out will only make things worse. So instead, I smile brightly.
"Oh, sorry I didn't call," I say. "When James picked me up from therapy, we decided to go to the river. It's such a beautiful day."
My mother glances up at the sky as if confirming this, and then she touches protectively at my arm.
"You're right," she says. "And I'm glad you're enjoying yourself, Sloane. It's nice to be happy."
Her expression darkens.
"It's just that after your brother, what if you..."
She pauses, choking on her own words.
"Everything will be okay, Mom," I answer,
the words robotic in my mouth from the number of times I've said them to her, the number of times James has told them to me.
"Everything will be just fine."
And then I open the door and go inside. Chapter 4. "So how was school?" my father asks as I stab my pork chop while we sit at the dinner table. I look up, used to this conversation. My parents' expressions are so worn, and yet they stare at me like I'm their last hope for survival.
"Good."
My mother smiles, giving my father a reassured side glance. Normally, from here, our topic would switch to the latest news, how the Northwest has the highest suicide rate in the nation. Could it be because of the rain? That the incidence of suicide is spreading to other developed countries and they're paying close attention to the program, hoping to adopt one of their own. And my favorite, how a scientist or doctor has claimed to have found a cure, propaganda by the drug companies who have lost revenue from the banning of antidepressants. But tonight, I'm too lonely to hold up my part of the conversation. The way Lacey returned, washed out like that, it makes me hate life, and it makes me miss her even more. Before she was dating Miller, Lacey used to go out with jerk-offs. She said bad boy was her favorite flavor. They were always older, too old to go to the program. I can remember a guy in particular, Drake. He was 20 and drove a Camaro. We were 16. Lacey showed up at my house one night wearing sunglasses, and I knew something was wrong. We went quickly to my room before my mom could see her. When she took off the glasses, I saw she had a black eye, cuts up and down her arm. She said Drake had pushed her out of the passenger door while the car was still moving. Looking back now, seeing how she cried because she didn't want her parents to find out, I wonder what else Lacey hid from people. How much I really knew her. We decided that she couldn't cover the marks, so we staged her falling off my front porch, calling my parents out to see her injured, setting up the alibi. She never told anyone else about Drake, although I told James, and he beat the hell out of him. I lied for Lacey then, just as I lied to myself as she got infected. Maybe if I were a better friend, I could have kept her out of the program. Maybe we're all sick.
"You're not eating," my mother says, interrupting my thoughts. "Everything all right?"
I look up, startled.
"Lacey came back today,"
I say, my voice wavering. My father's eyes flash with worry, and for a second I think that they understand, that I can tell them the truth about the program, how it brings us back empty.
"Really?"
My mother sounds nothing short of gleeful.
"Well now, see? That wasn't very long."
I have a gut check and look back down at my plate, the pork chop slaughtered around the bone, the applesauce bleeding into everything. "It was 6 weeks," I murmur.
"Exactly," my mother answers. "Went by faster than you thought."
I remind myself of the parental outreach the program uses, weekly support groups for parents of dead teens, access to the latest advances in their methods. It's like the program learned to get to us through our home lives. I think they can get to us anywhere.
"And how did she look?" my mother asks. "Did you see her at the wellness center?"
My fingernails are digging into my jeans, into the skin underneath. "Yes," I lie. "And she's blonde again. She's completely different."
I bet she looks beautiful, my mother says. The returners always look so healthy, don't they, Don?
My father doesn't respond, but I feel him watching me. I wonder if he's gauging my reaction, mentally going through the "Is your child depressed?" checklist the program provided them. I'm not sure I have the strength to put on the mask, but I look up anyway, and smile.
She does look great, I reply. Hopefully she'll be able to hang out again soon.
Just give her time to heal, my mother says, grinning at me like she's proud.
Thank God for the program. It's saving so many lives.
My stomach lurches and I stand up quickly, not wanting to cry when I've made it this far into the conversation.
I'll do the dishes tonight, I say, grabbing my plate. After that, I've got a ton of homework.
I rush from the room, getting into the kitchen just as the tears start to sting my eyes. I need to do something before I break into sobs in front of them. There is a pamphlet for the program sitting next to our phone in the living room, something every parent received when our high school became part of the experiment. But to me, that paper is like a threat, always reminding me of the next step if I slip up. So I don't slip up. Ever. I look around the kitchen, and my gaze rests on the gas stove. Walking over, I turn it on, the flames catching life in shades of blue and orange. I'm going to die if I don't cry right now. The sorrow is going to rip through my chest and kill me. But instead, I turn over my arm, the tender part exposed, and stick it into the fire. The burn is immediate, and I scream out in pain, backing away as I cover the area automatically with my hand. My entire body reacts, as if all of me is on fire. I decide that I like it. I like the pain and distraction. Tears stream down my face, even though the emotional release feels good, and I drop onto the tile floor. My parents rush in, and the minute they do, I hold up my arm, the blistered area bright red against my skin.
I got burned, I sob. I leaned against the stove to grab the pan, and the burner must have turned on.
My mother gasps and runs to turn off the burner.
Donald, she says, I told you to put the pots in the sink.
He apologizes and kneels down next to me. Let me see, sweetheart. And they fuss, letting me cry as long as I want because they think I was accidentally injured. They have no idea that I'm really crying for Lacey, for Brady. And most of all, for myself. James sighs. You shouldn't have started in the car. His voice is concerned on the other end of the phone as I hold it to my ear. I'm curled up in bed, my arm bandaged and Tylenol PM making me sleepy. That's the problem, Sloan. Once you start, you might not be able to stop. He pauses. I shouldn't have let you cry.
I just had to mourn a little. I say, not all of us can get tattoos.
This isn't about me. Now how bad is the burn? He asks.
Blistered.
God damn it. There's a rustling, and I imagine him roughly rubbing his face. I'm coming over.
No, I say, it's late. I'm going to fall asleep soon anyway. You can be sweet to me tomorrow.
I'm going to kick your ass tomorrow.
I smile. Really? You really think so?
Go to bed, Sloan. He doesn't sound nearly as amused as he normally would. I'll be there early to pick you up. And please, James says, don't do anything else stupid tonight. I swallow hard, too exhausted to cry anymore, and agree. After I hang up, I pull the comforter over my head. I think about my brother in my last moments of consciousness. Guilt heavy in my chest. Sometimes it hurts so much that I pretend he never existed at all, as if that can make me okay. But then I remember his smile, his jokes, his life. And I understand what my parents have lost and why they're so concerned about me. I ask myself if I'd be any different if I were them, but I don't know the answer.
I feel a light touch on my cheek, and my eyes flutter open. James looks down at me as he stands next to my bed, his face worried.
"We're going to be late for school," he says. "Your mom finally sent me up here to get you."
I feel confused and glance at the clock, seeing that it's past 8. I get up on my elbows and look around the room, disoriented. When I do, James moves to sit on the edge of my bed.
"Let me see your arm," he says, taking it before I can agree.
He peels back the bandage and I wince.
"I'm really unhappy with you right now," he says, not looking at me, just examining my burn. "I like your skin better without the scars."
His eyes meet mine, and then he leans down to kiss just above the tender spot on my arm. He climbs onto the bed and gets under the sheets next to me, not caring that my parents are downstairs and could come up at any second.
"I know it's not easy," he whispers, his breath warm as his lips touch my ear. "But we have to push through."
He picks up one of my curls and twists it around his finger, wrapping and unwrapping.
"Every morning, I think this will be it, the day I get sick, the day the handlers will flag me, take me. And I don't want to get out of bed, but I do, because I can't leave you here alone."
At the thought of losing him, I reach out to take his hand, squeezing my fingers between his.
"We have to fake it to make it," he says, sounding bitter. "And I don't make it without you, baby. Brady told us to take care of each other, and I'm not going to let him down again."
"I'm tired of faking it."
"So am I," he breathes. "So am I."
He pulls our held hands to his mouth and kisses mine. Then he turns and puts his lips on my neck.
"Let's ditch," he murmurs between kisses. "We'll say you have an appointment and go to the river, lie around in the sun all day."
I smile. "Didn't we do that yesterday?"
"Yes, but I could use another day off."
He takes my thigh and pulls it over his, leaning in to kiss my collarbone.
"Stop," I say, but it's half-hearted. Truth is, I could use the heat that James gives me.
But before we get too far, he sighs and pulls away.
"You're right. I really shouldn't take advantage of you when you're injured."
He sits up, pulling back the cover and exposing my pajamas.
"Wear a skirt, maybe," he says. "Staring at your legs always puts me in a better mood."
He flashes that broad smile as he stands. He goes to my door and pauses, his facade nearly crumbling. But without looking back, he nods, and then goes downstairs. Chapter 5. When we pull into the parking lot, I go to climb out of the car when James catches my hand.
"Hey," he says seriously, "I have to tell you something before we go in."
My heart skips a beat.
"What?" "I didn't want to say anything when we were at your house, but Miller broke into Lacey's bedroom last night, hoping to talk to her. He thinks he might get flagged today. I'll let him tell you the rest. But he's okay. He's alive."
I lower my head and try to catch my breath, taking my hand from James's before resting it on the dashboard to steady myself.
"He's okay?" I ask, looking sideways at him.
He nods, but there's something in his expression that keeps me from feeling relieved.
"Do you think they're coming for him?" I ask.
"I hope not." I close my eyes and throw my head back against the seat.
"Why did he do that?" I moan. "Why didn't he just wait?"
"I don't know," James says, "but I think we should take off early today, maybe after lunch. We need to keep a lower profile around here."
Says the guy who faked a school project at Sumter.
"That was different. I was trying to help Miller."
"It was dumb," I say. "We have to do better. It's our fault if they take him."
"I know that," James snaps. "Don't you think I know that?"
We stare at each other, his features taking on a wild edge.
James feels responsible for my brother's death, for my safety and Miller's safety. It's just how he is. And sometimes I'm stupid enough to believe that he can really keep us safe.
"I know everything you think," I murmur, despair settling in my chest. James's expression softens. Come here, he says. At first, I don't move, the impending threat on Miller making the space in the car, in the world, suffocatingly small. Sloane, I need you, James adds, his voice thick. And when I hear his plea, I push aside everything else. I lean into him, digging my nails into his back as I clutch him to me. He flinches and then squeezes me tighter. The minute I turn 18, James and I are going to leave town, start over someplace else. But we can't go yet. They'll find us, issue an Amber Alert as a way to track us down. We'd never get away. No one has ever gotten away before. We stay close until James's hand slides onto my bare thigh just below the hem of my skirt, his breathing deepening. My lips are tired of talking, he whispers next to my ear. Now kiss me and make me forget, he says. I pull back to see the sadness in James's eyes, the mix of desire there. And so I whisper that I love him, then climb onto his lap and kiss him, as if it's the last one we'll ever have. In economics class, I stare at Miller as he sits next to me with his head lowered, drawing in the notepad he has under his desk. I'm checking his mannerisms to see if there's anything that can get him flagged. He seems fine. Well, I whisper as the teacher starts walking around to hand back quizzes. What happened at Lacey's? Miller pauses in his sketching. I slipped in through her window after her parents were asleep. I tried to tell her that I wasn't going to hurt her, but she started crying. He shakes his head. She thought I was there to kill her or something. Who knows what the program has told her about me? I put my hand on my forehead, leaning my elbow on my desk. This is a major disaster. This is enough to get him taken away for sure. Did she call for her parents? No. Miller says. She told me to get out, even after I tried to explain who I was. She told me to get out. His tone is flat. I guess I was hoping that on some level she could still love me. He looks over, his eyes glassy. Do you think she could? Yes, I say. I do. But Miller, you could have been arrested, sent away, and then what? What would I do without you? I had to try. You wouldn't give up on James. I pause. No, I wouldn't. He nods, looking sorry that he made the comparison, and goes back to his notepad. Are you going to keep trying? I ask. No point, he answers. She's not the same person. I don't even think she'd fall for me again. I blink back warm tears. I'm sorry. I know, he says. I have to move on, right? At least, that's what my mom tells me. Miller's mom was never crazy about Lacey in the first place. She hoped her son would end up with someone more on the cheerful side. But in our lives, there isn't all that much to be peppy about anymore. And those that are have usually gone through the program. Miller, you don't... Sloane Barstow? Mr. Rocco calls, and then glares me into silence. Miller's head is down as he continues to doodle in his notepad under the desk, but I'm relieved that he isn't planning anything crazy. If we can just keep it together through this latest threat, we'll survive. And maybe in a few months, when her monitoring is over, we can convince Lacey to hang out with us again. James and I are leaving after lunch, I whisper when I'm sure the teacher isn't looking. You in?
Hell yes. You think I'm here to learn?
I smile. Miller sounds like himself for the first time today. Just before I text James to tell him it's on, I glance once more at Miller, catching what he's drawing in his notepad. A large, black spiral taking over the entire page. I turn toward the front, pretending not to notice. In my pocket, my phone vibrates. I covertly slide it out and check the message. Keep Miller close. Extra handlers on campus. Miller, I whisper. James says there are more handlers today. Do you think they're here for you? Miller licks at his bottom lip as if considering, then he nods.
Could be. Let's leave before lunch then, he says. We'll go to my house.
I agree and text James, glad to leave. The last thing I want is to see my best friend get taken away. Again. I sit next to Miller on his flower-patterned couch as James is in the kitchen rummaging through the refrigerator. Miller chews on his thumbnail, and when he moves to the next finger, I see that they're all bitten painfully short, bleeding under the slivers of the nail still there. I reach out and smack his hand away from his face, and he rests it in his lap.
Saw her on the way to school today, Miller says, staring out the picture window across from us.
Lacey?
Yeah. Drove by Sumter and saw her in the lot talking to Evan Freeman. She was laughing.
He begins biting on his nail again, but I don't stop him. Instead, I lean my head on Miller's shoulder and stare out the window with him. Returners aren't allowed to get too close to people for a few months after coming back, but they are allowed to make a few friends, especially if they're also successful graduates of the program. I guess the handlers figure that if they're both scrubbed clean, they can't be bad influences on each other. Before Miller, Lacey actually went on a few dates with Evan Freeman. She said he used too much tongue. And now, the fact that Lacey was talking to him, laughing, all while not realizing that she already knows him, makes me sick. It's so disturbing that I can barely handle it.
What do you think they did to her in there? I mumble, not sure I really want the answer.
They dissected her, Miller responds, spitting out a bit of nail. They opened up her head and took out the pieces, putting them back together as a happy face puzzle. It's like she's not even real anymore.
We don't know that, I say. She could still be the same on the inside. She just doesn't remember.
And if she never does?
He turns to me, a tear spilling over onto his cheek.
Do you really think anything can ever be the same again? She's empty, Sloane. She's the walking dead now.
I don't want to believe that. I've seen returners for nearly 2 years, and although I've never had more than a standing next to me in line at the mall conversation, I'm sure there's still people. Just shinier, as if everything is great. They've been brainwashed or something. But they're not empty. They can't be.
It would have been better if she had died, Miller whispers.
I sit up and glare at him. Don't say that, I say. She's not dead, and in time we'll try again. She may not know you, Miller, but her heart will.
He shakes his head, not meeting my eyes. No, I give up. I'm letting her go just like the psychologist said I should.
After the program took her, they sentenced me, James, and Miller to 2 weeks of daily intensive therapy. Therapy beyond the usual assessments. They asked for details, things they could use in her treatment. But really, I think they were trying to see if we were infected too. Luckily, we weren't. I want to tell Miller not to move on, to wait it out and try to win her again. But in a way, I know he's right. The way Lacey looked, how she acted, she's not the same, and she probably never will be. I remember the first time Miller met Lacey. I'd brought him to our table, hoping to introduce them, but Lacey was in the lunch line arguing with the lady at the register. Lacey was wearing this ridiculous black and white striped dress that made her look like Beetlejuice. But Miller got this puppy dog expression on his face. He leaned in and told me and James that she was exactly the kind of girl he was looking for. The kind who would piss off his mother. I shoved his shoulder, but James laughed from across the table.
Don't do it, man, James told him with a smirk. She's like a black widow. She eats dudes like you for breakfast.
And Miller just smiled as if the idea fascinated him. Lacey wasn't so easy to convince, but when they finally got together, they were happy. They were so happy. I'm sorry, Miller, I say in a low voice. He nods and then turns suddenly to hug me.
I rest my hand on the back of his neck as he squeezes me so tight I can barely breathe. I don't tell him it'll be okay, because I don't know if I can hope that it's true. Just then, James walks into the living room, biting into an apple. He looks at us, tilting his head as if assessing the situation. He takes another bite and walks over, leaning down to put his arms around both of us.
"Can I have some love too?"
he asks in the stupid way he does when he's trying to make sure we're not getting too sad. He's trying to distract us. He kisses loudly at Miller's cheek, and I laugh, pushing him away. James straightens, but Miller just stands and doesn't say anything. James's expression falters, and he shoots me a warning look, as if telling me I shouldn't have let Miller break down like that. I shrug, because I didn't mean to. Glancing around the room to figure out what to do next, James walks to the fireplace mantel and picks up the latest family photo.
"Man," he says, looking at Miller, "your mom is smoking hot in this picture."
"Go to hell," Miller says, biting his thumbnail again as he hovers in the doorway. They have this same conversation every time James sees Miller's mom, who is indeed very pretty. She's single, raising Miller by herself. She has blonde hair and wears short skirts, and has a possible crush on my obnoxious boyfriend, who she says is going to be a heartbreaker when he gets older.
Yeah, not if I can help it.
"I'm just saying," James adds, walking back over to the couch and dropping down next to me.
"If I didn't have this one," he hikes his thumb at me, "I might be your new stepdad."
I laugh, slapping his thigh. "Hey!" James winks at me and turns back to Miller.
"I can teach you how to play catch in the backyard, okay, slugger?"
"Fine by me," Miller says, his normally amused expression at the joke gone. "I'll take Sloane in exchange. I need a new girlfriend anyway." Both James and I pause and are laughing, Miller adding a new twist to the routine. Only, he doesn't say it like he's joking. He glares at James, at me, and then turns away.
"I'm going to make a sandwich," he adds, and heads into the kitchen.
James's mouth opens slightly as he stares after Miller, a bit of pink high on his cheeks.
"I think he was serious," he says, sounding confused. "Why would he say something like that?"
James glances at me, his brow furrowed.
"Does he like you?"
I shake my head, my stomach knotting.
"No,"
I say honestly. And the reason it's so alarming is that we know it's out of character, that it's a break in Miller's personality. It's a sign we were taught to watch out for.
"Should we talk to him about it?" I ask.
James puts his hand over his mouth, rubbing it as he thinks.
"No," he says finally. "I don't want to upset him anymore."
We're quiet for a long minute, the sound of the refrigerator opening and closing in the background. James looks at me.
"And by the way, you're not allowed to hook up with Miller."
"Shut up."
"I'll make you a deal. You don't hook up with him, and I won't hook up with his mom."
"James!" I go to hit him again, but he captures my hand and then pulls me onto his lap, making it impossible for me to get up. James is so good at making everything normal that I start laughing, trying to twist out of his grip. When Miller walks back in, a sandwich in his hand, he pauses in the doorway, no emotion on his face. I stop squirming, but James doesn't let me go. He nods his chin at Miller.
"We're clear that Sloane's mine, right?" he asks, not sounding combative, just curious.
"That I love her and won't let her go, not even to you. You know that?" I wonder what happened to the "let's not upset him" argument. Miller takes a bite of his turkey on rye and shrugs.
"Maybe," he says. "But we all know that things change, whether we want them to or not."
And without betraying any emotion, Miller backs off and leaves, walking slowly up the stairs to his room. James releases me and I sit next to him, stunned. Miller doesn't have feelings for me, I know that. He's just acting out. We've seen it before, how someone will piss off their friends or start sleeping around when depression takes hold. My brother acted out, but we denied it. We pretended not to see it. With that thought, I turned to James, my face tight with worry.
Should I?
No, James says, holding up his hand. I will. He kisses the top of my head before walking to the stairs that lead to Miller's room. He's going to try a peer intervention, something we've been taught since the 7th grade. This might take a while, he says to me. I nod, and then watch as James goes up to try to bring Miller back. In Miller's small, rooster-themed kitchen, I make some chicken noodle soup and eat it with crackers before washing out the pot. When I get tired of waiting, I move to sit on the stairs, listening for any sounds above as I rest my head against the wall. It's 45 minutes later when James appears on the landing. He smiles at me, a look that's to tell me everything worked out. Miller walks past him, and I back up into the foyer and watch him as he comes to pause in front of me.
James says you'd never go for me because he's a better kisser than I am, Miller starts. I told him we should put it to the test, and he punched me in the gut so hard I almost puked.
I dart an alarmed look at my boyfriend, and he shrugs.
It's okay, Miller says, touching my arm. I deserved it. I was being a dick, and I'm sorry.
His mouth quirks up in a smile.
I'm not really attracted to you, Sloane. I hope you're not too disappointed.
I roll my eyes and look back at James as he drops slowly down each stair.
Did you really hit him? That's my idea of intervention. Worked, right?
James is always thinking like that, that if he can distract us long enough, we'll forget how messed up everything is. He's right. It does work. But will it always? Will he always be able to make us laugh through our tears? I stare at him then, knowing how much I depend on him, on how he makes me feel. His smile fades as if he's reading the serious expression on my face. Rather than make a joke, he looks at the wooden floor.
Do you guys want to watch a movie? Miller asks, sounding more alive than he has all day. My mom won't be back until 4.
Your mom, James begins.
Shut up, Miller and I say at the same time.
James chuckles, finally glancing up, looking flawlessly charming. All is well. All is normal. We go into the living room, wasting an afternoon as if it were any other. But I can't help stealing looks out the window, constantly checking for the men in white coats. Chapter 6. For the next 2 days, Miller is himself, or a close enough version of himself. When he's not drawing in his notepad, he's staring out the window during class. Lacey must not have turned him in because the handlers haven't approached him yet. But there is one handler still hanging around, the creepy dark-haired one who side-eyes me. I don't mention him to James or Miller, worried they'll start a fight and get into trouble. Instead, I just avoid his gaze, trying not to get too freaked out. Miller, James asks as we walk out on Friday.
Are you sure you don't want to come camping? It'll be nice out there. Quiet.
Nah, man, Miller answers, taking his baseball cap out of his backpack and adjusting the brim.
I'm just gonna chill at home, play some video games, maybe stop by the wellness center.
You should come, I say. You're going to be lonely. Miller looks at me as he puts his hat on, a smile on his face.
It's one night, Sloane. It'll be fine. Besides, I already know how camping goes with you two. He motions between James and me. And no offense, but I'm not really in the mood for your public displays of affection.
James laughs and moves to put his arms around my waist from behind, resting his chin on the top of my head.
Not true, he says. We always wait until you're asleep.
I laugh and push him off me. But Miller still doesn't agree to join us, promising that he will next week. I don't want to leave him behind, but I don't think I can stay in town either. I like being out in the woods. I like pretending that there's no program. And so we say goodbye to Miller and climb into James's dad's car, heading for the coast. When we were younger, Brady and I would go camping together. My brother was an expert outdoorsman, so our parents let us go when I was just 12 and he was 13, although they'd come and check on us a few times. And when I was 15, they finally let us go on our own, as long as James was there too. That first night, as I sat next to the fire pit, I watched James put the tent together while Brady was across the site chopping wood. James had just turned 16, and his blonde hair had grown out so that he had to swipe at it with the back of his hand. He was such a boy, shirtless and sweating, muscles already cording on his tall frame. And at one point, he looked sideways at me, almost startled to see me sitting there staring at him. Then his mouth spread into a grin. "You checking me out, Sloane?" My face must have gone completely red because he apologized immediately, but I had already gotten up to walk to the spot that overlooked the ocean, unable to answer. He was right. I had been checking him out. It had never occurred to me before that moment that I thought of James as anything more than a friend, my brother's friend. I even had a boyfriend, Liam. Sure, I didn't much like him, just one of those, we have classes together, so let's go out type of relationships. But still, Lacey told me it'd be weird if I said no to Liam. I hadn't even let him hold my hand in the 2 months we were together, and believe me, that counted as pretty weird in everyone's book. And yet, there I was checking out James Murphy. I sat on the sand embankment and bent my knees, resting my elbows on them. James had lots of girlfriends, never any serious. And now that I thought about it, James dating other girls twisted my stomach. I groaned out loud, wondering how I could have let myself be so stupid. "God, Sloane," I heard. "I was only kidding." I straightened my back, unable to turn to face James. But I knew him, and there was no way he'd leave me without finding out what was going on. Then, sure enough, he was standing over me. "You okay?" he asked. His voice held no hint as to what he was thinking, whether he was embarrassed for me, whether he had even noticed that he was right about the way I'd been looking at him. I nodded, but he just chuckled. He tossed a tent pole on the sand in front of us and dropped down next to me, bumping me as he did. James was big, and I fell to my side, catching myself with my hands. Normally, I would have pushed him back, but I didn't want to touch him. I wanted to figure out how to make my feelings go away. Me, James, and Brady were a team. I didn't want to mess it up. "Holy hell," he said, sounding amused. "You really were checking me out." "I wasn't," I said quickly, turning to him. But it was too late. James read the truth all over my face. His easy smile slid away from his lips. "Sloane," he whined my name. "You don't get to do that. This can't... we can't..." He stopped, his beautiful eyes holding nothing but pity for me. So I did the only thing I could. I punched him in the chest, making him gasp, and got up and walked away. And here we are, over 2 years later. Once again, I'm watching James build a tent, but this time my brother's dead. James's hair isn't in his eyes, but he brushes at his forehead absently anyway. At one point, he looks sideways at me, but he doesn't smile like he did that day. Instead, his eyes are weary from putting up the tent by himself. He presses his lips together in an "I miss him too" sort of expression, and I look away. The team broke up, but it wasn't me who did it. It was Brady. The fire crackles, the heat licking out toward my boots. The sun set a few hours ago, but neither of us said much throughout the day. It was nice that we didn't have to. James taps my leg with a thin stick, and I take it from him, looking next to me. "Marshmallow?" he asks, holding one out between his thumb and finger. I watch as the amber light plays off his features, his strong jaw, his golden hair. I smile. "You're beautiful," I say.
"I look good naked, too," he adds. "You didn't mention that."
"I forgot."
"You forgot?"
He pretends to be offended,
and then takes a bite out of the marshmallow before tossing the rest into the fire. James immediately drops out of his chair, crawling over to mine and grabbing me, pulling me down into the dirt with him.
"James," I start to say, laughing.
But his lips are on mine, tasting sticky and sweet. He lays me back, his knee nudging my legs apart as he starts kissing my neck.
"James," I murmur again, only this time it's with longing. "I love this moment." Because as we roll on the ground, the fire burning hot as James peels off my clothes, I can block out everything else. I can focus on how good I feel right now. I can pretend that there is nothing else but us.
And when we're done, and James is panting next to me, proud of himself as he should be, I stare at the stars in the sky. I lie there for a long time as James pulls his t-shirt back over his head, collecting the wrapper to toss out. When he comes back, he gets down next to me, moving my head onto his lap as we watch the sky together.
"Brady's a star up there," he says, "in some distant place where he doesn't hurt."
James's voice cracks and he stops talking. He sniffles, the tears rolling down his cheeks. He always lets his guard down enough to talk in moments like this, the only time his feelings are so raw he can't hide them.
"He loved you," I say, curling up against him. "No matter what he did, you were the best thing in his life."
James looks down at me, wiping his tears.
"You were."
He stares at me in a way that reminds me that he's only human, that he's as fragile as I am.
"I was just his sister. You were more than a brother. You were his other half."
"Then I sucked at it," James says, "because Brady's dead, and I'm still here."
I sit up then, turning James's face to mine. "You're here for me. I wouldn't have survived without you, and I couldn't now. We're in this together, James. Don't forget that."
He exhales heavily and shakes his head as if trying to clear it. I know that telling him I need him, that I can't live without him, snaps him out of the depression. It always has. And when he's more himself, I kiss him again before taking his hand and bringing him into the tent to sleep.
"We should really camp more often," James says as we're driving down the freeway. I smile and look sideways at him.
"It was fun."
"And I think your memory is fully restored now," he grins.
"Yes, James, it is soundly intact and filled only with images of your naked torso."
He raises one eyebrow.
"Just my torso?"
"Oh my God, shut up."
"Don't be shy, I'm an amazing specimen."
James is still grinning ear to ear when my phone vibrates in the pocket of my jeans. I take it out, glancing at the number.
"It's Miller," I say, and then click it on. "Hey."
"Sloane?"
Miller sounds like he's been crying, and sickness washes over me. I reach out and grab James's arm.
"What's wrong? What happened?"
I say into the phone. My heart is racing in my chest.
"They're coming for me," he whimpers. "The program is coming for me."
"No."
"Miller, where are you?"
I shoot a look at James, and he's alternating between facing me and facing the road. His speed creeps up past 80 as we race toward town.
"I'm home," he whispers, sounding desperate.
"But it's too late. I had to see her again."
"Put it on speaker," James says, his knuckles white on the steering wheel. I hit the button, and Miller's sobbing immediately fills the space in the car. I nearly crumble, but I hold up the phone, keeping back my own tears. In life, I don't really get to see people cry. Not anymore. James does every so often, but it's rare. And other than that, it's only when someone has cracked that they'll let someone see. I never once saw my brother cry, and I was with him when he died.
"Miller," James calls out. "Don't do anything stupid, man. We're on our way."
"I just can't," Miller mumbles.
"I can't do it anymore."
I follow Lacey to the wellness center, and I tried to kiss her to remind her. But she slapped me and reported me before I took off.
My mom let it slip tonight that the program is coming. They're coming right now. But I won't wait for them. I won't let them take me.
Miller, James shouts so loud I flinch. What do you have?
Tears start streaming down James's cheeks and he presses down on the accelerator, sending us over 100 miles an hour.
Quick death, Miller mumbles. I wish Lacey would have told me and we could have gone together.
She wouldn't have gotten hollowed out.
We'd be together.
You can't be together if you're dead, James says. He punches his fist hard on the steering wheel, and I'm crying, looking for James to fix this, to stop it.
Miller, he says, don't do this, man. Please.
Miller sniffles. It's too late, he says, sounding far away. I took it 10 minutes ago, but I couldn't leave without saying goodbye.
He pauses.
I love you guys.
Then the phone goes dead.
I gag, the emotion too strong for me to contain, and James slams on the brakes, guiding us to the shoulder. He grabs the phone from where it fell on the seat, immediately dialing 911. He's covering his face, his body racking in sobs.
My friend, he yells into the phone, he took quick death.
I think I pass out then, because I don't hear anything else.
Chapter 7. The ambulance is gone by the time we get to Miller's house. There's no flurry of activity or sirens, so we know it's too late. We sit for a long time, staring at his white house with its black shutters. James doesn't hold my hand, and I don't reach for his. We're just quiet. The sun sets behind the house and the living room light switches on. We can see Miller's mother in the picture window, curled up on the couch. There's another woman with her, talking and wandering around. James and I have been in houses after a death before, and it's not a good place to be. Not when we're already so compromised.
Miller was going to be 18 in 3 months, James says, his voice strangled, but he doesn't bother to clear his throat.
He wouldn't have been scared of the program anymore. He wouldn't have done this.
It's a question we often ask ourselves. Would we commit suicide without the program? Or does it help drive us there?
I guess it doesn't matter now, I say, chills running over me as I continue to stare at Miller's house.
My Miller. My friend.
The first day I met him, he was playing with the Bunsen burner, and my homework caught on fire. Instead of yelling and dropping it, he grabbed my Diet Coke and doused it. Then he looked over and asked if he could buy me another one.
He came camping with us. He cut school with us. He loved us. He was such a good guy, and he was such a good friend, and I just can't...
Sloan, James says, pulling my arm. But I'm rocking, banging my forehead against the window, trying to make the memories, the regret, the pain go away. I want to stop moaning because I don't even know what I'm saying. But I can't control myself. I can't control anything.
And just then, James slaps me hard. I gasp in a breath, snapped out of my hysteria as my cheek stings. Normally, James would have talked me down, held me to him. But instead, his eyes are swollen and red from crying. His skin is blotchy and wet. I've never seen him look like this, and I touch my face, still stunned.
James hitches in labored breaths, his body nearly convulsing with them.
I've stopped crying, but my head throbs from where I was banging it on the glass.
James still says nothing, and then looks past me to Miller's house, just as the porch light clicks off. He whimpers, and I reach for him, but he backs against the car door. Slowly, he pulls the driver's side handle and opens it, falling out onto the street.
What are you doing? I manage to say.
But he doesn't look at me as he scrambles up, staring at the house with horror on his face. And then James turns and starts running, his sandals clapping on the pavement. I push open my door and scream after him. James! I yell. But he's around the corner and out of my sight. I can't move at first. I'm hyper-aware of everything around me. The orange haze low in the sky from the sunset. The trees swaying in the wind. I think about going up to Miller's house and asking if I can lie in his bed for a while. Feel close to him one last time. But that's the kind of thing that gets you flagged. Miller. I'll never go with him to the river again. We'll never have lunch again. He'll never turn 18. Oh, God. Miller. I blink, but no tears fall because my eyes are dried out and scratchy. I touch my cheek again where it still stings. It occurs to me that James didn't say anything. He didn't tell me I was being hysterical. He didn't hold me and tell me to cry it out. He didn't tell me it would be okay. He didn't say anything. Suddenly, my heart explodes with worry. I clamber all the way out of the passenger seat and race around the car, getting in the other side and slamming it into drive. I need to find James. I grab my phone from the center console and call him, my fingers trembling over the numbers. There's no answer until his voicemail picks up. It's James. Talk to me, baby. I hang up and dial again, turning down the same street where I saw him running. It's empty, and then the street lights turn on. Where is he? He needs to be okay. He needs to tell me I'm okay. I press down on the accelerator, looking frantically around the streets. James's house is only a few blocks away, so he might be there. I hope he's there. I'm going to find him, and I'm going to hold him. The car tires bump the curb hard as I pull up to his house. I run, not even shutting the door, and race to his front porch. I rush inside and yell for him, but no one answers. His dad isn't home, and I wonder what day it is, if he's on a date tonight. James? I'm screaming. James? Silence. I trip as I run up the stairs, banging my shin hard on the wood. I curse under my breath, but scramble ahead. I have to find him. I burst into his room, and the minute I do, I freeze. My James is sitting on the floor near the window, shirtless, in jeans. He pauses and looks up at me, his eyes red and swollen, his mouth slack. I barely recognize him. I hitch in a breath as he lowers the pocket knife, blood running down his arm, pooling in his lap. I needed to add his name, he says, his voice thick. I couldn't wait for ink. I drop to my knees and begin crawling toward him, shocked, horrified, desperate. Miller's name is carved jaggedly into his flesh. Blood is everywhere. James lets the knife fall to the carpet. He blinks like he's just noticing me. Sloane, he says softly. What are you doing here, baby? I reach for him and bring his head against my chest. His blood is warm as it runs over my hand. James lies there listlessly, as if he's empty. As if he's dead, too. And I won't cry anymore today. Because I know that James is now infected. It's going to be okay, I say, brushing back his sweaty blonde hair. No emotion in my voice, just the impossibility of it. Everything is going to be okay, James. Luckily, the cuts aren't too deep, and I help James clean and cover them with a bandage and a long-sleeve shirt. I go through his dad's medications until I think I find something that will calm him down. I clean his room, trying to scrub the blood out of his carpet, but then opting to cover it with a chair when I can't. I take the knife and throw it in the trash, considering hiding all the knives in the house, but I don't want his dad to be suspicious. James stares up at the ceiling, shaking even under the covers. I get into bed next to him, glancing at the clock, and knowing his dad will be home soon. I wrap myself around James and hold on tight. I wait until the pills take effect, and when he's asleep, I slip out. I hope that his father hasn't heard about Miller yet. I hope that he'll get home from his date and go to sleep, and then leave before James wakes up in the morning. Then I'll come over and get James ready for school. He'll need time, need me to keep him normal, but then he'll be fine. James will be 18 in 5 months, and then after that, they can't take him away. I'll keep him safe, just like he kept me safe after Brady died. Because that day at the river when my brother killed himself, I almost went with him. Chapter 8. My brother and I were only 11 months apart, yet oddly enough, we never fought. Brady was my best friend, one of my only friends other than Lacey. And even though he had James, he never shut me out. In the weeks before my brother died, James and I had been meeting secretly. When he'd stay over, he'd show up in my room at 3 in the morning, kissing me quietly while everyone slept. He'd leave notes under my pillow when I wasn't home. We'd become completely infatuated with one another. We didn't tell Brady, not because we wanted to keep it secret, but because we didn't want it to be awkward. And if everyone knew about James and me, they wouldn't allow us constant access to each other. Sleepovers, camping trips. Brady had been seeing that girl Dana, but they broke up. She told James that Brady was acting strange, that he was cold. James waved her off, but when he confronted my brother, Brady just said it wasn't a big deal. That she had bad breath anyway. My brother had made it his personal mission to teach me how to swim, always going to our same place by the river. There isn't much of a current there, just a deep pool of water. But this one afternoon, he took me and James to a new spot. "It's really beautiful there," he said as he drove. "It's perfect." James snorted in the back seat. "Just as long as I get to see your sister in a bikini." Brady smiled, his shadowed eyes glancing in the mirror, but he didn't tell him to shut up. Instead, he kept driving, like he had all the time in the world. I looked back at James, but he just shrugged. I remember thinking that maybe we'd tell my brother that day, that maybe it was time for him to know about me and James. I even thought that maybe he knew about us, but James didn't think so. He said Brady was just stressed about finals. We never got the chance to tell him. I was in my bathing suit as Brady stood at the edge of the drop, looking down at the rushing water. A soft smile was on his lips. "You can't swim in that," James yelled to him as he laid out his towel far back in the grass. "We should have gone to our usual spot." Brady looked over, the light reflecting off his black hair. The sun made his pale skin look sallow and shiny. "I didn't want to ruin it for you," my brother called. James pulled his eyebrows together and then laughed. "Ruin what for me?" "The usual spot. I figured you'll still be able to go there after. Maybe you can teach Sloane how to finally swim." He darted his eyes to mine and smiled. "She might listen to you." I paused then and stared at him. "What are you..." Ice-cold pain ripped through my body when it hit me, when the moment actually became clear. At just about the exact same time, I saw James jump up from his towel. My brother was poised on the end of a 20-foot drop, and he bowed his head to me, his eyes glassy. The dark circles under them were navy blue. I hadn't seen it coming. I hadn't recognized the signs. "Take care of each other," Brady whispered to me like it was a secret. And then he held his arms out at his sides and fell backward off the cliff. My screams ripped through the afternoon air, and I looked back to see that James was still too far away. I didn't know how to swim, but I ran full force and dove in after him. The minute I smacked the water, cold rushed up my nose and I choked, flailing wildly. "Brady," I tried to yell. But gulps of water kept entering my mouth. There was another loud splash behind me, and I knew it was James. I don't even think he saw me.